I want to welcome Robert Mattson to Upcoming Discs for a second time. We talked to Robert last Christmas time about Mission, and that was Jimmy Stewart and the fight for Europe. And now we're talking about another Hollywood legend and another airplane kind of connection, and that's the crash that killed Carol Lombard in Party on January 16th, 1942. How you doing, Robert?
Very glad to be here for my encore performance.
Well, you certainly deserve an encore performance. And to let the folks know, actually, Fireball was written prior to Mission, but we're celebrating a new release of the book, correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's it timed to the 75th anniversary, or commemoration, I guess, of the crash of Flight 3.
I'll tell you the first thing I have to ask you about. You managed to climb this thing, which, from what I understand, is pretty grueling even to this day. And then you describe that there are still pieces of the crash there, and you even found some human remains. So tell the people about this this trek there, and try to explain what you saw.
First of all, when you go to Las Vegas, the mountain that you can see highest and clearest is Potosi, because it's the tallest mountain around Vegas. It's to the southwest of Vegas, and it's visible from all parts of the city. And every time I would go there on business or whatever, I would see this mountain, and I knew in the back of my mind I had to climb it, and it was calling me for years. And finally, when I decided I was going to write this book about the plane crash, about Carol Lombard and her fate there, and the first responders, and everything that happened, I knew that the first thing I had to do would be to climb the mountain the way those first responders did.
Yeah.
And it was the experience of my lifetime. I mean, I would not do it again, because it threatens your life in several places. And the hardest part is coming back down, because then you can see, you know, when you have your back to the mountain and you're going up, that's one thing. But when you're coming down and you come down on your butt in some places,
right,
because it's so steep. And you see that if you take a wrong step, you're going to fall thousands of feet. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But so that was October of 2012, was going up. And when you get there, it hits you where you are. You're at a place where people died, and there's a lot of the plane wreckage is still visible there.
Mm-hmm.
It's still there because they couldn't get it out because it's too rough.
Right.
And yes, while we were there, my guide who took me up, he found what was part of a wrist bone.
Wow.
And then, to just make the story more dramatic, in 2014, some hikers found a skeleton. One of the crash victims was found there and identified through DNA. And the coolest thing of all was that the coroner's investigator, I met her while I was out in Vegas in January, and we sat and talked all evening about the fact that she used Fireball to identify the three possible people this could have been on the plane, and
mm-hmm.
then to use DNA to identify this as Second Lieutenant Kenneth Donahue from Stoughton, Massachusetts, and return his body to the family with burial with military honors in October of 2016.
Because we should mention that most of the folks that were on this plane with her weren't normal passengers. These were military people who were on their way somewhere, and this is, of course, during World War II, so you know, these are active military personnel that were lost in the mountain with her.
Yeah, there were 15 of them, and they were from the Army Ferrying Command. They were taking bombers from the west coast of the United States to the east coast, or to Canada, or even to England.
Right.
And they were on their way back to Long Beach, California. And these were really, you know, very valuable guys.
Yes.
Because this was right after Pearl Harbor, and these were regular Army guys, and most of them were officers, a few of them were pilots. So their loss was deeply felt by the Army.
Yeah, and as you mentioned in the book, there was also the concern of sabotage, which was a real, real concern during this point, because we're talking not too long after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, the feds that crawled over the mountain there the first few days after the crash, a lot of them were FBI, and they were looking for any evidence of sabotage. They were getting tips. I looked through the FBI files, and there were a number of tips that there was a bomb on the plane, or the plane was shot down, or you've got to look at this guy, or you've got to look at that guy, you know, and fifth columnists were around. And so it was a scary time for the feds as much as anybody.
From what you describe of this mountain as well, I mean, not that there's a fortunate place, obviously, to crash a plane. It's always an unfortunate event. But this has to be about the worst possible place. I mean, not just for the victims, but for anybody trying to do recovery. And as you said, stuff's still up there. So that has to play a big part in the questions that still remain 75 years later.
Yeah, when I went through, I was lucky enough to find TWA's confidential files on the crash.
Yeah.
And over again, there's documentation of these guys writing to each other, "Oh, God, tell me we don't have to go back up that mountain. That mountain was the worst thing I ever experienced." I mean, like, over and over again, it's like a testimonial to the, you know, the fearsome nature of that mountain.
Well, it surprises me that, and you do a very good job in the book of describing the relentless efforts by all these first responders and these people who attempted to go up there at first, hoping to rescue and then for recovery. And it just strikes me that almost a miracle that none of those people were killed during this whole process.
Yeah, the worst they lost a horse.
Right.
You know, and that's terrible. I mean, the fate of that horse that fell off the cliff is just horrifying, because he was carrying, this horse had on its back two of the bodies.
Right.
Carol Lombard's mother and Otto Winkler were on this horse, mm-hmm. when it went over the cliff. And, of course, those poor people are past caring, but that horse died a horrible death. And he made headlines, too. I mean, like,
yeah.
It was the most dramatic recovery effort, the most dramatic crash. It stole headlines from World War II, you know,
yeah.
for a whole weekend.
When you read this book, I mean, it's not just a book about about an air crash. I mean, let's be honest, you could be done with that in a few pages. I love the way in this book you give us incredible amount of background on Carol Lombard, what kind of person she was. And once again, you managed to give some homage to the other people, like you said, these valuable war effort people, and you tell us who they were and tell us a little bit of their story and even their family story. And that's the part that really gets me, is that you spent the time not just researching what must have been a mountain of paperwork, as it was just about the air crash in Carol Lombard, but you researched these people who never really probably got the attention at the time that they deserved.
Well, I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why that happened.
Okay.
It was because I was standing at the crash site, and it's so steep, you can't really even get footing. And as you're trying to get your footing on this, like, 45-degree angle,
yeah.
what you hear under your feet is just like the clinking of metal, just constantly, because the plane was blown into a million pieces.
Wow.
And while I was standing there, and it was dead quiet, those people talked to me. I mean, I can't explain it, but they communicated with me, and they were saying, basically, you know, "I was there, too. I was there. Don't forget about me." You know, it was the most powerful moment of my entire life, was when I realized that the story was so much more than Carol Lombard, and I realized standing there that I had to tell their stories, and that's why I really made an effort. And then I got so fortunate. In one case, the stewardess was the air hostesses, they called them at the time,
right.
Alice Getz. I talked to her niece, who remembered her and who brought her to life, and I got the family photo album, and, you know, that contained a whole lot of history. And she was like the star, like the celebrity of Kewaunee, Illinois, this tiny little Illinois town.
Yeah.
She sent postcards home and photos and mementos, and I was able to just, you know, recreate this person and give her to the world, this really cool woman, young woman who
yeah.
died at 25, you know, just one story amidst all these stories.
Well, exactly. It's kind of sad to lose your life in such a famous thing where somebody else is involved, and it's so easy to overlook these people.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is the headlines all screamed Carol Lombard and 21 others.
Right.
Not in plane crash, but the other 21 were just as important to
yes.
their loved ones, you know, and to the world as the most famous one who died.
Right. And I have to tell you who else you brought to life for me. I mean, everybody knows who Clark Gable is. I mean, he's larger than life even today. But you show in the book a side of Clark Gable I don't think anybody's seen before. You really bring out the vulnerability, and you bring out, you talk about the relationship a lot, and you really get into his mind. And I want to ask you, how did you do that? How did you get inside that part of Clark Gable that he really didn't show to a lot of people?
Well, he was the toughest nut that I had to crack up until Jimmy Stewart.
You know? I believe it.
Gable took a lot of time, and I talked to people who remained, who knew him.
Mm-hmm.
I searched through interviews, countless interviews he did, and I finally got the vibe of the guy, that he was just such a flawed human, but in his way, I admire how he channeled her death and what he did with his life afterward. I you know, it's hard to defend Gable when you read what kind of a guy he was before she died. But then after she died, his turnaround is just so inspiring, you know. He'll always have his detractors, and they will not cut him slack for after she died. But but I do, and I give him a lot of credit. And I once I got his vibe, it was just like a very deep understanding.
Well, and I get that impression from the book. His character speaks to me as much as anyone else, and I think that I have more sympathy for him as a survivor than even the people who perished on the mountaintop. You really bring his internal struggles and stuff to life, and that's, like I said, a side of him I don't think anyone's ever put in a book before.
Well, I appreciate hearing that. I mean, really, because he was the toughest for me, and I still hear some noise from people about, you know, my presentation of Gable, and yeah, but, you know, he was a louse or whatever. Well, you know, everybody's human, and nobody's perfect, and he was as imperfect as anybody, but I give him a lot of credit.
And I also have to say, your depictions of Carol Lombard's life as you kind of put together crucial pieces of her life, it seems to me that a lot of what you give us is kind of tied to the crash, because her own personality had a lot to do with her ending up on that mountain. And, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. You couldn't script this if it was fiction. Somebody would tell you you're just going too far with the idea that she fought to stay on the plane, that she, you know, her wanting to get back because of a fight with Clark Gable, all this stuff. I think that you're building towards that, and I assume that's what the purpose is on everything you give us, is that you're trying to show how she contributed in some ways, unfortunately, to her own demise.
Yeah, there's a certain inevitability to everything that happened, and yes, she rushed to her own doom, and it was part of her nature. I mean, like, she had conquered everything up to that point.
Yeah.
I don't know if she believed in her own luck. I don't know if she believed in her invincibility, but, you know, it was one risk too many that she took, and she died like she lived, and she died, I believe firmly, she died the way she wanted to die. She wanted to die on the top. She said that herself. She wanted to die while she was on top. She didn't want to wither away.
Right.
And so, you know, unfortunately, a lot of really wonderful people went with her. And and two of them, her own mother and Clark Gable's best friend, the press agent, Otto Winkler, you know, they went kicking and screaming to their eyes alongside her.
And you even say, when you look at the title, Fireball, it has a double meaning in the book, doesn't it? And you go on to even mention that in the book. You're not just describing the crash, you're describing Carol Lombard, aren't you?
Of course, yeah. She was a fireball. I mean, she was as energetic and down-to-earth and full of life as anybody you can possibly imagine. You know, she was a wonderful person, a take-charge person, a go-getter, an independent person, emancipated. She believed in the equality of the sexes.
Right.
You know, and on and on. She was quite something.
You make an interesting observation in the book as well. You say that her life can easily be compacted into these four accidents. Can you tell us a little bit about what that's about? And, of course, you explain them in the book, but can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a really weird thing how four accidents deflected the course of her life. And the first one was before she was even born. That was when her father had an industrial accident that gave him some sort of brain injury that caused him to have, like, horrible blackouts and the rages that caused Carol's, or Jane Peters as she was originally known, caused her mother to take Carol and her two brothers away from Indiana, as far away as possible, and that was to Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
Carol grew up amongst Hollywood people, so that was the first thing. The second accident was when she was 17 years old. She was in a car crash that tore up her face when she was just starting out as an actress.
Right.
And if you ever met Carol Lombard in person, the first thing you would notice when you shook her hand, you would look at her face and say, oh my God, she's got scars all over her face. I mean, this was a scarred movie star, which is crazy. She had terrible lacerations that were never really healed.
But they hit it with, like, makeup and hair, particularly by how they styled their hair, right?
Yeah, it was a lot of things. It was lighting technique, it was makeup, it was hairstyles. And more than anything, it was just her unwillingness to let it stop her. She would not let that stop her. She continued towards stardom anyway. That was the second accident. The third was when her lover and boyfriend, Russ Colombo, died in a freak shooting accident. He was 26 years old. He was a singer, Bing Crosby's big rival, and he had just started on a movie career. And you can't believe the freak nature of this accident where he died from a gunshot from an antique dueling pistol. And that was the third thing. That shattered her.
Right.
And that led to Clark Gable, and Clark Gable led to the fourth accident, which is the one that killed her, because she was rushing home to be with Clark Gable because he was, frankly, fooling around on her.
And the big fight, which of course led her to, she was supposed to take the train back, correct?
That's right. She was ordered by the government not to fly because of the dangers of air transportation at that time.
Right.
Plus, if you think about it, it's the dead of winter, and winter travel is dicey even today. You know, you always have, like, trepidation when you get on an airliner in a snowstorm or whatever. But, well, that's what she was doing. She had chosen at the last minute to not take the train she had tickets for, but to get on a plane because it was going to get her home 2 days faster. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter to her that it was winter. She just wanted to go home.
Now, the book describes a coin toss, but I get the impression you might be a little skeptical about that. What do you think? You think the coin toss happened?
I do think the coin toss happened.
Okay.
I do, just because there's enough smoke there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Otto Winkler, the press man who was Gable's friend, did not want to fly.
Right.
He had dreamt and told his wife, he dreamt that he would die in a plane crash if he got on a plane on this trip. That was a shocking thing that I found in the papers of his widow.
Right.
And Carol's mother had never been on a plane. She was 65 years old. She had spent her life avoiding air travel because she was scared to death of it. Well, Carol wanted to get on that plane, and those two people tried to stop her, and Carol said, well, we'll flip for it, you know?
Yeah.
Heads we go by the train, tails we, or whatever. I guess Otto actually called it, and he lost the bet and lost his life.
Right.
And they all died because of that coin flip.
And of course, again, this goes back to this fight over, was it Gene Harlow?
No, it was Lana
Turner. That's right. It was Lana Turner that they had this fight over, and it's the longest they had been separated since they had been together, correct?
That is correct, yes.
And then I guess he tried to make up, sent some flowers, and I guess they had some telephone conversations, and she just really wanted to get home and make up with her husband.
Yeah, and he had planned a little dinner party. You know, I think in her mind she envisioned that he was laying entwined with Lana Turner, but no, he was looking forward to her coming home, and he had Carol's brother there, and Carol's best friend was there, and they were waiting, you know, for Carol to come home, and Clark gets this sudden visit by two MGM men who come into his house in Encino and say, look, you know, there's been some sort of problem with the plane. We got to get you out of here right now. And, you know, that started the whole weekend of terror for Clark Gable.
To his credit, I was surprised by the fact that he just rushed up, not even dressed, prepared for it, that he was prepared to climb the mountain himself. I was moved by that.
He was a man's man. I mean, that's what they called him at the time. And to me, what that means is, you know, he was such a regular guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was an outdoor kind of a guy. And that mountain was nothing to him. I mean, he didn't stop to consider anything other than, I'm sick of this crap.
Right.
And I'm going to get up that mountain. And he would, well, and the you know, part of the problem, as you read in the book, is that he was bombed. I mean, he couldn't eat any food, but he sure could drink away his troubles.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he's, you know, he's in the bag, and he's trying to climb this mountain, and that's when the officials met him. He was trying to go up. They were coming down, and they said to him, you know, please don't go any further, because everyone's dead.
From all the information that you had to go through, all the research you did for this, even climbing the mountain yourself, I got to feel that you probably did as much work on this as any investigator who ever worked the case, you know, officially. The obvious questions I have to ask you are, what do you think really happened? Since there aren't definitive answers even today, what's your personal belief? What do you think really happened?
Well, I think it was a thousand little things. When something this horrific happens, you want there to be a giant, big, smoking reason why it happened. It's like, you know, when a president like John F. Kennedy gets killed, we want there to be an international conspiracy,
yes.
You know? But, but really, in this case, it's this cascading set of tiny dominoes, like these little dominoes. One falls against another, and then pretty soon there's a plane smacked into a mountain. And I really believe it was a whole bunch of little things.
Yeah.
And the one thing I can't answer for you is how TWA's most experienced pilot let this happen and flew this plane at, you know, climbing speed of 185 miles an hour, how he managed to fly directly into this cliff. I can't really explain that part of it, but I can tell you, you know, my theory on everything else.
Well, he was quite a bit off course, wasn't he?
He was off course, but other pilots that night could see the mountain.
Right.
They could see the mountain, and how he couldn't see the mountain is a problem for me, and I was just in Vegas last month, and it was, you know, I was trying to gauge, okay, it is 7:20 p.m., how dark is the sky, and whatever, and it's really not quite full dark in that week of January, and so that is still a mystery, even though a lot of people will say to me, you know, there's no mystery. The pilot flew into terrain. They do it all the time. They still do it today.
Yeah.
Well, this was a really special pilot.
Well, and that's the problem. I get the impression you're a little skeptical about the fact that it was too easily put off to pilot error. And they do that even today. I mean, that's going to be the first place airliners seem to always go whenever there's a problem.
Yeah, and I've ended up being a defender of Wayne Williams, the captain, because he was a World War I pilot, he was a barnstormer, he was a male pilot, you know, and those male pilots, they were tough, because it didn't matter what the weather was, they were in an open cockpit, and they were going to get the mail through in 1920 when nobody else could, you know, so he had a tremendous amount of experience under his belt, like 15,000 hours flying or whatever. He had more flight time than the training pilot, the captain of the fleet in TWA. You know, he was more experienced than the civil aeronautics guys that investigated the crash.
Now, you mentioned it in passing, but of course I'd be remiss if I didn't bring this up, because we're talking about the 1940s, we're talking about the Nevada desert. You make the mention that there were some people that reported UFO activity, so is this a big UFO conspiracy going on too, or is that really never amounted to anything?
Well, I report it because it's in the FBI files.
Sure.
And like when I was a teenager, I was a big UFO person, and there were flaps, and I would follow them, and whatever. But it makes me tremendously uncomfortable to even put it in the book, because I don't think UFOs were involved. But the really crazy thing is that the two witnesses that gave testimony to the FBI on this issue were civil aeronautics guys.
Right.
And that sent shivers up my spine, and it sends them up even as I'm telling it to you, because these are highly credible witnesses, and they saw unidentified flying objects before there even were such things, really, you know, on the record. They saw them in the flight lanes two nights before the crash. You know, the FBI said it, the aeronautics guy said it, so I repeated it in the book.
Well, yeah, obviously, it's not something I realize that you're necessarily taking seriously, but there are going to be people out there that are going to try to make that connection, especially with what happened later with Roswell and all that kind of such. So, you know, I had to bring it up, and I know it's not a serious contention, but it's something that that people are going to ask about, and that's why I brought it out. There's people going to make that question.
Well, it's the thing that makes you go, you know?
Yeah. So being there, you know, before we get finished here, again, being there, and you talked about these people speaking to you, how much time did you spend on the mountaintop?
We started at dawn. There were three of us who started, and two of us made it up. And we were there on site at the crash scene for about 90 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And then we came down the mountain and got back to the vehicle after dark.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like, it was a 12-hour trip.
Wow. So and most of that, of course, is spent. Is it longer to get up or come down?
Longer to get up. because you come down really fast.
Well, it's surprising, too, that you do mention another crash that happened, looks like about 10 years ago. But have there been, are these the only two crashes reported in that mountainside?
There was another one, and there was a helicopter crash. But those two that I describe are the two that happened in that section of Mount Potosi.
Right. And were there remains of any of those crashes that you could see, or could you just not tell? It was all just a bunch of mangled mess under your feet.
No, Potosi is a vast mountain. I can't tell you how big it is.
Right.
So I don't even know exactly where that NASA, that Civil Air Patrol plane that crashed in 2007, I can't tell you. I know it's close. It's like a quarter of a mile away, but I didn't come anywhere near that site, I don't think.
So it didn't hit in the same neighborhood. It just basically hit the same mountain.
And it was in the vicinity, mm-hmm. Which is why it's such an irony that in 2007, you know, in modern computer aviation with a fully functional, vastly equipped cockpit,
yeah.
Two very, very experienced pilots, one of them from NASA and the other from
yes.
the Civil Air Patrol, crashed into that mountain without any warning, and it just, see, again, I am a defender of Wayne Williams, the
yes.
captain of Flight 3, and I think it vindicates him, because
yeah.
it's a treacherous mountain.
It absolutely is. And now this new book, this new version of the book, it has new material in it. Can you tell us what's new in there for anyone who read the book before and is interested in learning more?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. Carol's Baha'i religion, her faith was not really talked about in the original. When I was on the ground in Indianapolis on the book tour, I found some really interesting information, and I toured the Capitol where she spoke. I stood on the spot where she sold bonds. There's a lot more detail on the day selling bonds. There is her whole speech that she gave on national radio.
Yeah.
And the contents of the FBI files. I did not have all of them at the time of the original writing, and there's a lot more information in there about the crash from the FBI perspective,
sure.
including that UFO information.
Well, I have to tell you, it's a page-turner. I picked this book up originally intending to spread it out over about a week worth of reading time. I ended up doing it in just a couple of days because I couldn't put it down, because it really drives you towards what's going to happen. And it's one of those things where, you know, like on Apollo 13, people say, well, but you already know what's going to happen. It kind of doesn't matter. You get driven towards that point. And I have to say, you did a great job of building up the drama, building up the suspense, getting us to know even the most minute characters involved in this. And that's a heck of a tribute. It's a book that you won't be able to put down. So I warn anyone who's thinking about buying this thing, don't pick it up on a night where you don't have a lot of time.
Well, it's all by design, Gino.
Yeah.
You know, you fell into my trap. That's all I can say.
I did, but you know the worst part about that, it's a quick read. It's 300-some pages, but, you know, now we're waiting for the next one. So tell us what's coming up next. When are we going to get something else out of your hands?
Well, I'd love to tell you, but then I'd have to kill you because...
No scoop.
No,
I
have an idea for a Hollywood World War II book that's going to complete this trilogy along with Fireball and Mission.
Okay.
And I've been sucked down this path of starting this book, and I hope it works out because it's gonna dwarf the other two if I pull it off.
I assume you're in the research stage now, whatever this is.
I am. Yes, I am.
So we're not
into it. In fact, that's where I'm going to go as soon as we're done here.
So we're not going to get a chance to see this for a couple of years.
Couple of years, but I write fast.
So it's not only a fast read; it's a fast write. I have to ask you also: are you a pilot?
I am not a pilot, and people have asked me that. I was a NASA aeronautics guy, so I have a lifelong interest in aviation, but it never pulled me into, you know, becoming a pilot. I've been up with a lot of pilots in smaller aircraft, and that's one of the things that allows me to fool people is because I know enough about it to be highly dangerous.
You describe these things in pretty good terms, so it sounds to me like somebody who's very familiar with the whole practice of it.
Yeah, I'm familiar enough, and I've been in a lot of flight simulators, you know, and whatever, but you wouldn't want to go up with me alone.
So let me tell you, writing about this air crash and, of course, people, you know, flying bombers in all the dangers of World War II, does it make you more or less nervous flying?
Less nervous, really. a very safe technology unless something, you know, catastrophic, unforeseen happens, you know, and then it's a matter of fate, and that's out of our hands.
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, I want to thank you for providing an excellent read, also giving me a chance to get more background to both Clark Abel and Carl Lombard, because you told me things I had no clue about. In fact, I had to get on my wife because I didn't realize that Riggs was so far back, and you talk about her entrance into the tennis world, and I start to realize that Battle of the Sexes wasn't fair in the 70s, because he must have been in his 70s when he played Billie Jean King. I didn't know he was a tennis champ in the 30s.
Yeah, he was, and I think at that time, what was he, in his 60s, early 60s, yeah. But, she was deeply connected in the tennis world, and my wife and I are huge tennis fans now, so, I mean, like, it's sort of this continuum, and it's very cool.
Yeah, well, it's certainly an interesting read, and I want to thank you for bringing it to us, and I'm really bummed it's going to be 2 years before we wait for the next one, but I'll be definitely one of your people waiting to read it.
All right, Gino. Well, I appreciate that.
All right. Well, you take care, and thanks for sharing the story with us.
All right. Thanks very much.